Yeah. In July 2014, there was this 17-year-old boy from Bergen, originally, who had this idea of trying to start a comprehensive campaign by using so-called denial of service attacks, and it was actually a distributed denial of service. It started like out of curiosity and out of some very low-level motivation, but eventually it had huge consequences. The attack was able to stop or at least interrupt functioning in several big companies in Norway, starting from several banks such as Norges Bank, Sparebank, and Nordea or Danske Bank. It was even able to shut down the website of DNB for more than 1 hour and a half. And also, it went further by interrupting activities for Storebrand, Telenor, Norwegian, and SAS. As I mentioned in the beginning, this all started because he was trying to see what would happen if something like that would propagate in local networks in Norway. According to the media and the police, he was probably alone, so this was like his own idea. Yeah. And but furthermore, since he was like 17 years old, it's probable that he was also helped from some other more experienced cyber criminals, as we will see later on. So he might have the idea, but he didn't have the right tools or something, so he used some help from outside. And so he wanted to make aware the community that such events can occur, such attacks are possible, and they might be associated with high costs to all the companies that could be affected. And then we might say today that actually it's very easy to have these denial of service attacks, these distributed denial of service attacks. They are sold today as a typical product. They are offered online. I'm not saying that you can try it, but they are very easy to find, and they all have this typical product, customer service, fixed prices, also money-back guarantee if you don't get what you need. So everything is already there. So in this lecture, we will discuss and define what are the main threat actors, the main threats, and also vulnerabilities. And we will do that while it's already known that there are different categories of attackers, different levels of competences among them, and it's also true that there are different levels of skills required for different types of attacks, and there are many different goals involved. So an attack, it's very, very difficult to be explained in terms of just curiosity or something else. So let's start with some definitions, and I'm using here some main terms from the ISO 27002 material on the security guidelines and measures. It's the International Standards Organization that provides these reports. They are updated frequently, but this is like main definitions, so they are like stable through time. So when we talk about threats, we should understand that a threat is a typical cause of an unwanted computer incident that may occur to a single asset or to the whole organization. And then when we mention incident, what's an incident? It's like a single or a series or of unwanted events. They may also be unexpected because no one really, it's like typical case when you have this attack, when you have your computer like halted and you can't do anything, and this is like very unexpected and highly undesirable. So, and in this case, these events have this significant probability of compromising business operations and threatening information security within the organization systems. Then we talked about event. An event is an occurrence of a certain system indicating a possible breach of policy, or also it may be related to unknown situations or a possible failure of controls over the system itself. And then when we talk about assets, an asset is everything that has value to the organization. So it might be human capital, it might be, and it's always information. They say that information is the most valuable asset that an organization has. So, yeah. And then when we talk about vulnerability, we should understand vulnerability as a typical weakness of a system which can be exploited from different malicious actors in order to make possible that the threat turns into a possible attack. So, generally speaking, if we are part of an organization, we might say that an asset is everything we need to protect. A threat is what we should try to protect the asset against. And then a vulnerability is any type of weakness or gap that results, that is part of our protection efforts, that is part of our systems and so on. So threats are always present, as you also might understand during this lecture, while attacks are just related to actual events. So it's not always possible for a threat to turn into an attack, but once it does, it will have more consequences. You may find in different books or several sources or websites, etc., that they always try to associate cybersecurity, cyber policies, measures, etc., to this old material, to this ancient author from the years around 500 before Christ. His name was Sun Tzu. He was a Chinese general who at that time was able to write this military document named Art of War. And in that time he was able to provide some good lessons about the importance of knowing yourself and the threats you face when you are against an opponent. He was typically talking about military events and wars, but anyway, his lessons are still very much interesting. So in these terms, whenever one of you will be trying to protect his own information or his organization's information, you should know that it's very important that you know how to, that you know yourself. So it's like you have to be familiar with all the information and the systems that store, transport and process your own information. And also you have to know the threats that you are facing. And in this case, in your case, or in the especially in the organization's case, you have to make clear to the management about various threats that can be associated and can be very harmful to the people, applications, data, and also information systems that are within the organization. In that case, you would help them make more better decision, make proper decision making. So what are the types of attackers? Why should we study them? Well, I have this link from some days ago. So it's the Twitter CEO, Jack Dorsey, whose Twitter account was hacked. So it's like, if we are able to hack the CEO's account of Twitter within Twitter, what's there next left to be able to do or to be able to breach? So a typical attacker would be individual or a group who attempt to exploit several vulnerabilities for either personal or typically financial gain. So it's starting to get more and more money related. So it's like getting into a certain industry or business of its own. And the attackers are really interested into anything of value. So they might do anything to have that, to possess that kind of asset or information. What are the types of attackers? We start from discussing about the amateurs, which like typically have limited skills or maybe no skills at all, but they are also like trying to use whatever is there in the market already, trying to use existing tools, searching the internet, downloading some tools and so on. They are typically called script kiddies. So if you ever heard about the term, this is also very much related to this category of attackers. They are usually doing this out of pure curiosity, just trying to find out what can they do with the information they have. But then there are also others that try to demonstrate their level of skills, and by just doing that, they can potentially, as the teenager guy from Bergen did, cause harm and have devastating consequences. And whenever I talk about the script kiddies, I remember this other case of a 20-year-old boy from the U.S., but I'm not sure about the correct state. Maybe it was New York. He was actually the one that was responsible for attacking or for breaching Uber information systems, I think, 2 years ago. So it was like a real case of this thing. He was like 20-year-old. He was living with his mom and his smaller sister. They were having financial problems. So he was thinking about a way how to solve this. And then he breached Uber and caused very much problems in that company. Then, after the amateurs, we will increase our level of skills and talk about hackers. Hacker is like a typical term for all the possible attackers. So it's very much known, and it's like the term that has been going around since at least 30 or more years. It was initially related to all the high-tech, high-skilled guys who were able to use a computer to program something and to make most of it. And nowadays, it's like more usual jargon for all the main types of attackers that are able to get into a system and to gain access into it. So, whenever we talk about hackers, there is this subcategorization of them in terms of colors of hats. I think you probably know about this, but it's good to already repeat something like that. So We have the white hats, the black hats, and the gray hats. I also have a colleague here who has all these types of hats, like, you know, the real hats. And he always plays around and says, am I a black hat or a white hat? But anyway. So, white hat. The white hat hackers are all of these typical attackers that have this ethical behavior, or they are just trying to get into a system, not because of some personal financial interest, but more out of their need to protect themselves, their colleagues, their other companies, and so on. So they aim to discover weaknesses in the system, and by doing that, then they report it to the system owner. On these terms, you may have heard about all these hacker challenges, which is like different companies worldwide trying to persuade people from all over the world to try and attack their systems and try to see if there are any vulnerabilities, if there are anything that could go wrong in their system, so that can they improve it. And then we have the black hats, which is the total opposite one. So it's like any type of attacker who just starts this in terms of personal financial gain. His activities are mostly illegal, and he is always trying to put himself into a situation where he's always like opposing the authorities or different organizations. And then we have the gray hats, which are somewhere in the middle. So the gray hats are hackers that sometimes may behave good, like, for example, sometimes they may report whatever they find to the organizations, to the system owners, try to make them aware about what's going on. But other times, or others, other gray hats, could actually, once they find some information, could actually just make it available online and expose it to all potential black hats that are there. So it's like they might be doing something related to white hats or something related to the black hats. They are somewhere in the middle. And then we have the organized hackers. So it's like once we go through the other types, they are mostly related to individual activities. But we also have groups. We also have organized groups. So it's like starting from cyber criminals. So we have professional groups of cyber criminals who are like focused on taking control, on having more power and gaining more and more wealth. It's like they are like part of this industry chain. They are like highly sophisticated, highly organized. They are also able to provide cybercrime as a service. So it's like if anyone else is there asking for some help, they will provide it and they will be paid about it. And this, everything like this happens in the dark networks. And then we also have the hacktivists. That's like a combination of hacker and activism. It's like all of these attackers that are trying to do something in order to express their political ideas. It's really about some campaigns they need to promote and so on. They want to create awareness to several issues and so on. So even the case that I showed you from the attack to the CEO's account, it was probably a hacktivism doing that. So yeah. And then also we have the state-sponsored attacks, the state-sponsored attackers that are able to gather intelligence and commit sabotage as related to what their own government asks them to do. So they are all about doing espionage, sabotage. They are also very highly trained and also very well funded because they have the they are backed from their own government, and they are one of the most dangerous groups that there is there, because their attacks are focused on specific goals, and they may be able to do anything. And there is also another group which is like cyber terrorists. This is another type of organized activity where the hackers are trying to attack systems in order to conduct terrorist activities. And yeah, there are several cases that somehow are related to cyber terrorism activities. And once we are over with the types of attackers, let's talk more about the types of threats. There are certain ways to categorize the threats. We will deal with two of them. And then we will talk more about the other parts of the lecture. So, according to a paper from Whitman and Mathort, which will also be part of the reading materials for this lecture. There are 12 different types of threats that can impact the information security processes in a certain organization. First of all, it's compromises to intellectual property. Then it's deviations in quality of service, espionage, forces of nature, human error, information extortion, sabotage, software attacks, technical hardware or software failures, technological obsolescence, which is like related to devices, equipment that are really old, so they might be very highly seeked type of threat, and also theft. So each organization should be able to prioritize the threats based on the particular security situation where it's operating, also the organizational strategy regarding risk, and also the exposure levels for each of its assets. And then there is also this other categorization, which is very straightforward. There are threats which may be originating from outside the organization or inside, within the organization. And then we can easily divide them into internal threats and to external threats. We'll talk about internal threats in the beginning. So there is a highly possibility that any breach or attack of any kind can start from something wrong that an internal user has done. So the human factor, insider threat, whatever you may call it, is one of the most well-known reasons for this increase of attacks and breaches and so on. So that's also like from different surveys, the organizations know it, the CEOs know it, but anyway, there is not much to do in about that. So there are these internal users that can be accidentally or intentionally mishandling confidential data, threaten the operations of servers or internal network devices, facilitate attacks by just connecting these USB media, which is like very, very popular. And also, maybe they would accidentally invite malware into their own computers or into the organization systems because they just opened this email or they just tried to access this malicious website and so on. But in this case, as mentioned before, we should also say that internal threats can cause greater damage than external threats because, well, internal users are able to access anything. They have direct access into internal facilities. So if there is a typical card access, like here in this building, if someone else knows the code, if someone else knows how to access a typical room, this is how he can have the access. And then you also have access into the devices, which is similar. You have high knowledge about the corporate network, about resources, about the data that are inside, stored into the databases and so on. And then you also have different levels of user access and different privilege associated to your role into the organization. In all these cases, you are very much a target for all the external threats. And then the external threats are likely to increase whenever you or the organization that you are representing is connected to the internet. So in terms of that, we might say that today, yeah? Yeah, we will talk about Hydro. This is, it's part of the lecture. Yeah, thanks. So, if you think about that, the internet. According to the statistics from internet, currently there are like 4.5 billion users worldwide. And that would mean, in other words, 4.5 billion potential attackers worldwide. And this is like 60% of the total population. This is like a very high rate. So there are like almost 8 million people around the world, and 60% of them can access the internet through their computers, devices, and so on. And this is really like, this is the case that we have today. And we also should know that the world population is increasing. And the internet penetration rate is increasing. So it was like 30% some years ago, and now everything is being increasing in high rate. And also, organizations are more and more reachable online. All the, even small businesses, medium businesses, have their presence online, either through social media or through their own websites. Everything is online today. So there is an ever-increasing pool of potential attackers that can reach any type of organization in any time. And how do they do that? They do that by primarily looking for vulnerabilities. So when we talk about vulnerabilities, we also have to start thinking about categorizing them. And as I mentioned before, as in the different types of attackers, different types of threats, different types of attacks, there are also different types of vulnerabilities, multiple types of vulnerabilities. And there are different ways how to categorize them. So, first of all, let's look from a higher level. So, whenever you have this computer, whenever you are trying to protect it from whatever there is outside, you have to protect both the hardware and software, right? So, I think, so you're also doing other courses here, and you may have done other courses before in the high school and so on. So hardware and software are like whatever is part of the typical computer. And so in vulnerabilities, roughly speaking, we have hardware vulnerabilities and software vulnerabilities. When we talk about hardware vulnerabilities, we talk about specifically design flaws, or like something that's been built wrong from the beginning. And that's also specifically related to certain devices. So not all hardware have the same problem, right? So whenever you see something like that, it's always related to some specific model, some specific device on some specific time, and so on. So some typical hardware vulnerabilities, design flaws, a bit of history. So let's say when we talk about the random access memory, it's all composed of different components, smaller components, that are installed very close to one another. So in this case, whenever someone has access to one of the components, he can also access whatever is there in the other close components, adjacent components to that one. And so whenever there is some change in one of these, this can also affect the others, the components that are nearby. And so when this was discovered, it eventually became a way how to get into, to get access into a certain RAM and to know what information is there. So this is how Rowhammer worked. Rowhammer was a certain type of tool that was trying to retrieve data from a certain memory component within RAM, within RAM, yeah. And from there, it would go to the nearby memory cells, and it would get access into them, see whatever was there, and also maybe try to change it or try to do something about that. And then there was this also this famous Intel chip bug several years ago. So Intel was at the time very popular. They produced chips and they distributed them to all over the world. But at a certain point, they had this floating point bug, which is like whenever you try to do a typical mathematical calculation, the system would stop working. So there would be something. Actually, this was discovered from some researchers at the time, but Intel was able to reply to those announcements and just mention that, you know, not everyone will be doing that, so it's okay. We'll just deliver them, and it's they are okay as they are. Eventually, it became very... it had very large consequences because once this was published, everyone was trying to do that, and then all of the Intel chips were not working. So it was like they had to retrieve all their chips, and then they had to produce another statement where they... like were almost surrendered, and they said, you know, all new chips have bugs. So it's like we have this chip, we produced it, we released it into the market, but it had bugs. It's okay. We produce another chip. It might also have bugs. It's okay, because this is like a continuous process. We produce something and then we try to improve it and so on. But you know, that shouldn't be the case. And then we also have the famous case from 2018, Meltdown, which is also related to hardware, and it's also like very recent. So these are typical hardware vulnerabilities, and these are highly common when there are attackers out there trying to attack a specific company, specific devices that it uses. But this is not like the usual case, right? So we don't see these highly targeted attacks all the time. So hardware vulnerabilities are a bit more difficult to exploit and also a bit more rare. Yeah. So what was so I have it. I have a link here. Yeah. So it's a Wikipedia link, and it's a hardware vulnerability affecting Intel chips and also IBM processors and so on. So it's a typical hardware vulnerability, and I had this information there. But you have the link also, so whenever you want to see more about that, you just have to read more about it. I might maybe be able to provide more reading material about that. So it's also very much, so I don't want to get into details of everything here. So I think Meltdown is a very recent case of how there are a lot of these hardware vulnerabilities and how they can be exploited further, or they might be exploited, because this was more raising awareness about the case. It wasn't that maybe there were some problems or attacks about that. So yeah, and then and then we have the software vulnerabilities. The software vulnerabilities are highly related to the errors in the operating system or application code. They are also called sometimes software bugs, and it's actually very highly recommended to avoid these vulnerabilities by performing updates, having the latest antivirus tools and so on, patches and so on. But still, these are like the most dangerous vulnerabilities. So when we talk about software vulnerabilities, there are different categories as well. There is this vulnerability called buffer overflow. So it's like whenever you have this data written into memory, you have these allocated memory space dedicated to certain types of data. And whenever you try to write data, they would be limited by this buffer space. Now what happens is that you try to write different types of information, like just numbers or so on, and then when this size is almost filled up and you try to write more of that, then there comes the problem of buffer overflow. So this is also like trying to make the system crash and then trying to compromise the data that are within the system, and so, and then you try to attack the system and to provide this so-called privilege escalation. We will talk about that later. Then you also have this non-validated input, which is like when you're trying to transfer input data that are not appropriate for the typical system that is there. So it's like if you want to try, for example, to transfer an image file which has this invalid features, or let's say size or other properties that actually could force the program itself to not correctly process it, and that's how you get maybe the system to not respond very well, and that's how you start maybe after that a type of attack, or you just try to make the system crash so it's like not working anymore. Then you have the race conditions. The race conditions are always there when there is this timely and ordered range of activities that needs to be carried on, when there is this output that depends on other outputs. And if you are able to change this. If you are able to create another order, so it's like changing the order and not allowing one process to be finished before the other and so on, this could also be very much a case of a system crash or some other problems. Whenever we talk about software, there are always companies that, in order to limit their costs or something, they are trying to solve the problem by themselves. So they are trying to add some features, to add some procedures, some security-related procedures that are not just like, let's say, existing in the market, are not like approved from a lot of companies. They are just their own procedures. But whenever this is the case, there might also be a lot of problems with it. So it's like trying to build your own program instead of buying something that's already there, that the market has a very good value for that and so on. So in this case, we should have the developers use whatever is there, which is like currently very much popular and tested and verified, and they should use the security libraries that are already existing. So it's not about trying to save some money, it's more about trying to be more aware that you need to count on something that is already there and it's like very tested and proved. And then you have of course the access control problem. So it's like when you're trying to control who does what, the role that is associated to someone, the task that he has, what devices can he access, what facilities and so on. And this is one of the most popular cases of using a software vulnerability and trying to get access into a certain system by just getting these roles. But anyway, whenever we talk about this, whenever we talk about software vulnerabilities or hardware vulnerabilities, it's recommended that either physical security or maybe even a typical malware protection could be enough to get over this. And then that's when we start talking about malware, and then we will talk about that in the next hour.
I was at this security festival and at the Hydro presentation, so it was quite interesting, you know, seeing everything and then connecting it to this. Mm. I just thought, well, while we were at the same time, I'll just mention it. We're going through later, yeah?
Yeah, we'll go through. It's part of the last section.
It was also really interesting. Casey. That he said that anyone would have fallen for it because it was a compromised partner that then... That they had already discussed with them and email, which
so
you know,
there was this guy from where who talked about this.
The CISO of Hydro had a presentation about the attack.
Oh, okay.
So he
So, since I had one of the students remind me before we go on with the lecture, there is this CCIS lecture this Friday. It's a usual event in Antoniejovik. Actually, this is a seminar because it's provided from a PhD candidate. So this is like they try to distinguish. And it's about a study of ways to improve understanding and governance in the cyber domain. It's going to be held in the same room here on Friday from 9 o'clock. So if you would like to join, just for that. So we go on. Yeah. So we'll talk now about malware. Why should we talk about malware? Because everyone talks about them. Malware, or more something else known as malicious software, it's the most common way how the attackers could gain access into your files, your personal information, and so on. So malware is like software designed specifically to perform malicious or unwanted actions. They are constantly used to steal data, to pass by different access controls, procedures, to cause harm, or even to compromise the system. And then when we talk about malware, we again have some different ways of categorizing them. I just use one of them. And in this way of categorizing, we will first talk about the most common malware that is used to get access into a system, to get within a system. And then other types of malware that are like also used to perform actions once the attacker has access within the system. So we will first talk about the malware, about how they distribute into different systems, and then what do they do or how they perform. And then we also have this blended attack, which is like you use different types of malware, different types of tools, and you do that to have more probability of success, and you do that for specific highly targeted attacks. So, starting with the most common malware, we'll talk about viruses. What is a virus? Similar to the typical virus that we have learned about in biology, the viruses are malicious codes attached to any other executable file or program. They usually require end-user activation. So it's like whenever you receive something, you download it. So this is the end-user activity. And then they can be activated at a specific time. And so you download it, and then you want to access the file, because why you download it? And once you access the file, then it starts working on its own. And then it gets usually spread via removable media, USB media, any other type of removable media, internet downloads, or even email attachments, which is like typical case. So I'm talking about a virus, and one of the most common known viruses from history is the one called I Love You. So the I love you virus came as an email, had this attachment within the email, had this interesting subject, and then it invited you to open this sort of postcard. So in order to get more, you know, in order to get something good out of it. But actually it was bad. So the author for this is someone from the Philippines in 2000. He did this by putting some Visual Basic script within this email. Whenever it was downloaded, it would execute, so it would then try and perform all the other activities. It would overwrite all file types with its copies, so it would be like multiple copies of the same document, and then it would be able to execute a file which would steal passwords and relevant information from your computer and then send it back to him. With this thing, with this small thing he did, with this interesting thing he did, he was able to put damage on 10% of all connected computers at the time, which was really big. And it was perceived that the total costs were like 15 billion of US dollars, and it even reached a high peak of more than 45 million people affected within one day. So it was really big. And then we go to the next common malware, which is called Worms. Worms, as their usual real life animal, are a malicious code that replicate themselves by exploiting vulnerabilities in networks. Worms are known, and they are highly different from viruses in terms of how they are able to replicate themselves. They don't need another software. They are not part of any other executable file. They are working on their own. They are independent. They are also known to usually slow down networks. And they are responsible also for some of the most devastating attacks. So in this case, let's talk about a worm known as the Morris worm. The Morris worm is by History of Information Security, you will also find it everywhere, is the first worm known. It was actually, it's funny, because it was devised from this postgraduate student. So he was a researcher, he was a student, postgraduate. His name was Robert Morris, and created on November 1988, so it's like more than 30 years ago. He tried to create this sort of self-propagating program, which would be able to reproduce itself from a node to another node and so on, and would try to infect all other machines whenever he reached one of them. And actually, he just tried to see, it was like some kind of experiment. He was trying to see what he could do with that, right? But then it got worse. So it got worse than he was expecting. Everything was so fast. It got replicated multiple times. He infected a lot of computers, a lot of systems, including military, academic institutions, and also many corporate organizations that had at the time these systems built. And actually, he predicted something about it, because he was working at the MIT at the time, and he used the MIT computers to do that. So he was able to somehow hide his identity for a while, but then eventually he was caught. He had to pay a fine, I guess. He had to do some community service, as is the usual case. And now, today, he is a professor. So actually, you might end up very well doing this kind of stuff. I didn't do this, so yeah, not yet, actually. And then you see the estimated cost is about $200, was about $200 per site. And then you have another common malware, which is like known as a Trojan horse, whatever. Trojan horse is as similar as a name it has. So it's like it usually goes within a system, tries to hide himself as a very interesting, good thing that you have to download, you have to access, you have to do it. And then eventually it becomes malicious. So you can usually find this hidden into image files, especially video games. And it sort of differs from the other malware that we talked so far because it cannot replicate itself. So it's just like into one single system. And this is actually how it usually works. So you have this file, this image, this game that you want to access. Usually free game, so it's like even more interesting. And then when together with this free game, you also have the Trojan horse that gets activated once you access it. And then it starts working on its own, monitoring computer activities, installing backdoors. We will talk about that and so on. Then what happens once we have this first malware installed? What happens when the attacker has now somehow some type of access into the system? He uses other types of malware. For example, he uses something that would target the integrity of the files there, according to what we mentioned as the CIA triangle or the McCumber's cube. So he would use logic bombs or backdoors or rootkits. He would use logic bombs that are like working like a ticking bomb. So it's like whenever you do something that triggers it, it gets activated and then starts working and doing more harm further. So it can be like a specific date. There was this example of some malware that were activated each third day of a month. So it's like each third day they would be activated, they would do something, and they would repeat itself the next month, on the third of the next month, and so on. And it can also use this, for example, whenever you open your user account, it gets activated and does something, or whenever you access a program. Then what can it do? It can delete your files, attack the operating system, and do whatever else it's usual to do. You have the backdoors. What's a backdoor? The backdoor is a program that you usually design and code in order to get a secondary access option to the system. So it's also like something which is created from the own developers of something. So it cannot always be bad, but it's also similar to those ones. So it can be like both ways. And it's able to grant future access even after the vulnerability is fixed. Then you have the rootkits, which from its name, root, it's able to modify the operating system in order then to let the backdoors in. So it can access the computer by using a backdoor, and then it can perform this high-level privilege escalation, able to modify system files. So what is the privilege escalation? Is an unauthorized modification of a system user account in order to gain advanced access and also to change your access role and your privilege. So that's why it's called privilege escalation. Other malware types trying to target integrity and availability. We talk about bots. I think you all also heard about them. They are very popular. It's a type of malicious software that is very similar to the word robot and performs similar actions. So they are specifically designed to automatically perform what they are asked for, right? So you ask them to do something, they do it. And they are usually activated or performing activities online. They are typically used in botnets, where there are many and many computers infected with these bots that are quietly waiting for someone to ask them what to do. And then, once they are part of these botnets, they are also frequently used in the so-called distributed denial of service attacks, which is like a coordinated use of many different infected computers using these bots and botnets to launch a certain denial of service. And the denial of service is just like some action that provides interruption to network services for users, devices, or applications. And so whenever we talk about the denial of service attacks and the distributed denial of service attacks, one of the most popular ones was the Groom botnet from 2012. At the time, it was able to control mostly around 1 million units, computers. And this was like 18% of worldwide spam traffic at the time, until it was shut down in July 2012. Then we have malware types targeting confidentiality, which is also very dangerous. So we have the spyware, adware, scareware types. Spyware are malicious software designed to track and spy on the user. They usually include also activity tracking, keystroke collection, so it's like what are you typing, and also data capture, whatever is there that can be accessed. They often modify security settings, and they are usually bundled with other legitimate software, or they are also associated with other Trojan horses. Adware, advertising. So they're mostly related to advertising, but they also might come along with other spyware, so they suddenly became dangerous. And then you have also the scareware, which is from the name scary, because they try to make the users access or download or open that link, because otherwise something bad would happen. So they try to persuade the users of using them out of basically fear. So it's like pop-up windows that are similar to operating Windows, operating system Windows. And they are telling the user that the system is at risk, you need to download this, you need to do this, you need to perform this action, and so on. But actually what they do is, by persuading the user to do this, they actually get him to activate these other malware. So then the system should be infected. And then, furthermore, we have the so-called ransomware. Ransomware are very highly typical in the last few years. They are specifically designed to hold the computer system or its data, the files that are within that, ransom, like captured, until a payment is made. This is usually what has been going on since at least 2 or 3 years now. They are usually encrypting the data in order for the user not to be able to see them and access and modify them further. They usually hold the key to that encryption, and then they are also usually spread by some file that you download or something or some vulnerability. So the most typical example of a ransomware, we will also get back to it later on, it's the WannaCry. The WannaCry, as you can see from the image there, was able to affect more than 150 countries worldwide. So computers spread around more than 150 countries. He was actually activated on the 12th of May 2017, It was a Friday. It was just right after people started thinking about the weekend, so no one was really able to understand what was going on. But that was, it was also a bit huge. And it was also like a typical ransom worm. So it was a worm that was used to hold captured some data, some systems, and so on. And it was spread via email. So basically, it affected more than 200,000 computers worldwide. And the system most affected was Windows 7. So whatever was built and created on the Windows 7 operating system was affected. Further on, by using the malware or other types of ways to attack some systems, you can perform this typical cyber attacks, which I actually try to categorize into attacks that are trying to steal personal data, as in passwords, or other attacks. So, in attacks trying to steal passwords, you always have this talk about social engineering. So you always say social engineering. I think some of you also have heard it. So social engineering is like trying to use social skills. So these attackers are employing their best social skills in order to convince their target to provide them with some useful information, some personal information, or anything that could enable them to access personal data, passwords, and so on. So it's like trying to be connected to someone in some kind of way, and then trying to find a way how to make this connection real, look real as much as possible. Then, once you get some personal information, you will be maybe able to get access to the system, and you will be maybe able to find out more information. But you can also try some other ways. You can also try this brute force attack. What is a brute force attack? It's like trying out all possible combination of numbers, characters, special characters, and so on, in order to find out what's the password for this user account. Now, if I show you the next slide, you will understand that this is not a good idea. So it might take several years or even several thousand years for the worst case if you want to do this brute force attack. So what we have today is that usually attackers are able to narrow down this possible combinations. Because that's why they use the social engineering stuff. So they use this stuff to get to know more about their target. They get to know more about their pets, that personal way of living. What do they eat? Where do they go? Where do they work? And so on. And so they try to narrow down the list of possible passwords. And so then they use the so-called dictionary attack, which is like using possible passwords, list of common names, activities, and so on. And so you have less combinations and a higher possibility to get the user password. But then you can also end up in a similar table, which is like more easier to get over with. But still, what's left then? Well, you always have the phishing stuff. So you can always use this email, send an email where you put this link and you invite him to access this link. You invite him to get to this website. And then That website is actually where you get all your information. So it might be a phishing email that is sent to anyone without a specific condition, or maybe with a few conditions. But it also might be a highly targeted phishing email, which is also called like spear phishing, you know, like in the phishing activities. But then you also have some other attacks. For example, if you want to use mobile, you have the smishing attack, which is like phishing through SMS. So it's like you get an SMS that invites you to go somewhere, to log in somewhere, because you suddenly have won something. It's like a typical email but sent by SMS. And then further on, you have the farming attack, which is like impersonating a legitimate website while trying to deceive the users and trying to get their personal information. So it's like imitating a common popular website. We've had this. I'm not sure if you already received this. We've had this common announcement in INSEA about this websites trying to trick you, to get you to use your personal account information from NTNU in order to get some access. But it wasn't NTNU website. It wasn't authorized from NTNU. It was just someone trying to steal personal information from NTNU contacts. So yeah. And then you also have the whaling attack, which is like trying to get the big fish, right? Whales. So trying to get the CEOs. Trying to get the management, the leaders, the politicians, celebrities, senior executives, whatever. And then there are also attacks related to the network. So it's a sniffing attack whenever you want to understand what's being transmitted. You can use these so-called sniffer tools that can observe whatever is there on the network traffic, even if it's not related to them. Then they can then target a specific protocol, service, even some specific character strings. But they also might be beneficial as when they are being used from network administrators in order to understand what's doing. Okay. Then you have the spoofing attack, which is like once you get access to a certain device, you know that this device is communicating in a very trusted way with another device. They are not requiring any kind of authentication, but even if they're so, they are like able to communicate between themselves in an easier way. So whenever you can get access to one of them, you can also get access, you can get connected to the other one, then get access to both of them, and so you can then try to attack and try to get the information you are interested in. And then there's also these men in the middle or men in the mobile, which is like trying to intercept communication, trying to change the data that is being transmitted, and trying to gain full control. This can be either between computers. This can be also using mobile. So it's like intercepting communication between a system and a mobile, and then trying to get access to them. Yeah. So, as you see, I'm trying to mention attacks, vulnerabilities affecting computer systems and also mobile, because this will be also the main focus of the lecture. So it's like computers and mobiles. We are every day using mobiles, tablets and other portable devices, so this is very real-time relevant. So let's go on and let's try to finish this lecture by sharing some basic information about several cases worldwide. Let's start discussing more about the WannaCry. So what was actually the WannaCry attack? It was a malware, I mentioned it before, that it was used to encrypt the user's data and then ask for a ransom. The ransom should be paid in bitcoins, And the value of the bitcoins would be like something around $300 in 2017 US dollars per unit affected. So if you wanted to get your files back, you have to pay it. And there were people paying it. I remember that I was having a lecture on that on like a month after this everything started. And it was like there were people paying it, so the total amount was like $50,000 at the time paid. So yeah, there were people and companies and organizations paying that. And it also uses, it's a ransom worm, so it uses this worm spreading functionality. So it's like going from one unit to another, spreading, propagating further. And it does this by exploiting this well-known at the time SMB vulnerability, which is like a server message block vulnerability that was eventually part of the Windows 7 operating systems. So there was this Microsoft Windows protocol vulnerability for file sharing. They used it, and then it was used also to propagate it further. The thing is that there was this vulnerability. It was also leaked. So there was this group, shadow brokers, who exposed it online. And then as soon as it was exposed online, you could have organizations like attentional security guys getting this information and trying to do something about it. But there were also these other guys who tried to exploit this and try to attack the system. So as soon as some of the companies worldwide, some of the institutions tried to deal with this, it was already late. So yeah. And then you also see the timeline of this attack. That is like the typical view you have when you were trying to access the computer that was affected. So there were two possible propagation scenarios. Either it was everything started by a phishing or spear phishing attack, which was like sending an email with a link to someone, and then followed by this worm functionality and so on. Or either the users try to do this so-called port scanning. The attackers try to do this port scanning. So it's like trying to see which of these computers might have this sort of vulnerability. And then once you get to understand this, then you start attacking them. But the good thing about this is that the code itself also, it seems it included this so-called kill switch, which is like a way out of it. So it's like a way to stop the effect of this worm or whatever malware, and also a way how to slow it down. So it was actually discovered very soon. It was discovered from this tech guy. Malware Tech was his account name in Twitter, I guess. And he was able to do it. He was able to identify some domain that was part of the code. He was able to understand what was the code like within the malware. And he was able to find this domain, and then once you get access to this domain, the effects would be less dangerous. Maybe it will stop. And the funny thing about it is that I think a couple of years, maybe last year, I guess, this same guy, the malware tech that had this kill switch found, was arrested for something similar. So it was like, this is the case. Sometimes you get credit about something, and some other time you get caught. So let's move on to the next case. I think we also talked about this a bit, Norsk Hydro. This is very recent, this is very local. I think you all heard about it, you were curious about it. So actually it's said that everything might have started from a simple email that was sent to someone who was part of a third party, like it's like those partners, those companies that are related, like very remotely related to one of the activities that the Hydro is responsible. But then, even though it's like remotely related, it's that related that it can do this. So yeah. And then the official statement from the Hydro, Norsk Hydro guys, said that the attack was able to provide this lack of ability to connect to the production systems, causing production challenges and temporary stoppage at several plants, while on the other plants they were forced to do everything manually. So it was like that. And then what you have is that from the information so far, it said that it was executed using a system file vulnerability, which is called PS-exec. And then it was this file, this specific file, was used to attack the systems. So, but another thing was that the network was already compromised. So it wasn't compromised in March, which was like 19th of March, I guess. But it was already compromised, so there was already something there. So there was this initial malware installed. And it might be this, one of these typical that I talked about from maybe Worm or something. But then there was also maybe this phishing email related to it, or maybe some brute force attack. But anyway, there was something before that eventually triggered this other events. And also it's already understood that the ransomware that held captive these systems didn't try to get money out of it. At least this is what can be thought about if you try and look at the ransomware itself. So it didn't want to get some money back, it just wanted disruption. So it targeted the system, the plants, it wanted to have them stopped. And so, So actually the ransomware was called LockerGoga. You can maybe try to search about it and try to find out more about it. And LockerGoga is not the first time that it was used as a ransomware. It was also used in January, and it affected this French company, Altran something. But still, it was also used in Norsk Hydro attack, and usually whenever it gets access to your systems, it sends this file, this text file, which says that this is a ransomware attack, you can try anything, but you won't be able to decrypt your files, you have to do this and that, and so on. And after that, it's able to log off all other user accounts. It's able to encrypt most file types, so whatever you have there, it will be encrypted. You cannot access anything. It's like at least 19 types of different files. Sometimes it happens that you cannot boot the system. So whenever you try to open it, it asks you to restart it, but then you won't be able to do it. But it seems that it's not typically a targeted attack, but it might be if someone is able to use it as such. Even in this case, it looked like it started from somewhere else, and actually the consequence was that I think Norsk Hydro is today having some very large costs. It's predicted to be like 75 or something million US dollars, so it's not that little. But then also it's not a worm. So it's different kind of malware. Oh, okay. So it's more typically something that cannot get propagated, so it's like targeting one single system. At least this is what the sources that I found told. And then we have the Twitter account, the initial case. So what was that? It happened just a few days ago, on 30th of August 2019. It was a Friday, so again, a typical time to use this kind of attacks. There was this anonymous hacker who took over the Twitter of the Twitter CEO, the Twitter account of the Twitter CEO, and it was already understood that there was something going on because he started tweeting like something like Nazi Germany did nothing wrong, and this was like typically not him because he was already trying to support all these opposing attitudes, so that was typically not him. So then people started thinking, okay, there must be something going on. And then there was this statement from Twitter, and then there was this chuckling squad who took responsibility of the event, and they are supposed to be hacktivists, so it's like a hacktivism activity because they were trying to promote some ideologies with this attack. But this wasn't the first one. This was just the last one from a range of high-level profile attacks they have been doing in order to get people aware of them. And actually, the funny thing was that it was a SIM swap attack. So it was based on mobile. Have you heard about SIM swap? It's very popular nowadays. It used to be less popular before because nowadays we are using more and more our own devices to have this authentication. Ways to get access into a certain account. It's similar to a smishing attack. So you use your phone, you send SMS to a mobile user, and you trick them into getting information somewhere by using these official companies' names or so on. How it's managed, so in the first thing is that the attacker will try to get access to your individual information by talking to the carrier and by trying to persuade them that he is the owner of this phone SIM card, and he would like to transfer the services from this SIM card to another SIM card, which would be his own one. And in this way, he would get access to all your information that are related to this SIM card. So it's like he would have access to this so-called two-factor authentication procedure, which is like when you try to log in somewhere, you have this